This is the Pedestrian Podcast.
I don't know. That's just what pedestrian, average, mediocre receivers do. What's up? What's up? My man Deion Sanders, we all right, huh? We all right? Yeah, we all right. We gonna go to the Super Bowl again, being all right.
The official podcast of the UK Seahawkers. Here are your hosts, Stuart Court.
Le'Veon Bell wants to be paid as an offensive weapon, when if you're the Steelers, he's come across as a bit of a weapon himself in different ways.
And Adam Nathan.
It's tricky because Hugh Jackson said nothing for me to shove him in.
We are going to follow you. You lead us, okay? Like I told you before, you lead us to darkness, we will follow you.
Go Hawks.
Welcome to another episode of the Pedestrian Podcast. Myself, Stuart Court, is as ever joined by the triumphant return after his honeymoon last week, Mr. Adam Nathan. How are we, sir?
I'm good. Apparently you feel like a different man being married, but 9 days in and no change, I still feel like a complete idiot. So we're good.
Yeah, there's only so much change you can, a man can go through in a week, and that...
That is true.
This week, as we talk about the Seahawks returning from Mile High without a W... Rob Staten is joining us once again. How are we, Rob?
I'm good, thanks, guys. Yeah, not too bad. Glad the football's back. Just wish the Seahawks had a better start.
So obviously we'll dive straight into what happened on Sunday. The Seahawks travelled to Denver, Mile High. There's a lot said about how much time they spent in the city and the altitude on Twitter, as there always is something that comes out of it. But the Seahawks did lose 24-27 to the Case Keenum-led Denver Broncos. We'll start at offense. Russell Wilson was not very good on Sunday, Adam.
No, I was thinking what we were gonna, you know, how I was going to talk about the game, and it's not necessarily Wilson's fault, but I think when we started off the game and you saw the Disley touchdown, I thought, all right, we're going to play almost like a proper offense that's like recognizable. And then I was thinking about how often we're just behind schedule and how it never seems to be like first and 10, second and six, third and two, first down, and how rarely we just seem to just move the chains and go up like a normal team. Like, to call back like a very famous drive, obviously, like the tip for the San Francisco, they just churned out first down after first down after first down, and it just doesn't seem to be the team that we're going to be. And it's not Wilson's fault necessarily, there's so much that goes into it, but I really thought we were going to see like a different and more sort of formulaic offense this year. And I know it's only one game, so it's silly to make huge projections, but it just felt a bit like same old, same old.
Yeah, well, 19 of 33, 298 yards, three touchdowns and two interceptions. The last one, the second one, coming on the final play of the game. But Rob, it's the two interceptions and all the six sacks he took. It comes down to his decision making, which was severely lacking at key parts on Sunday, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was really disappointed actually with the way that he played, and I think going into the game there were certain things that I think everybody expected. So I don't think anybody expected the pass rush to be good, for example, because it just isn't going to be this year. I think everybody expected that the rookies would struggle a little bit, because it's the first game, we had so many new players playing that was going to be an issue. And I think everybody expected that Von Miller was going to have a good game, because he usually does. So I think those are the things that you assume were going to happen, and they all came true. What I didn't expect to happen was for the offense to just be, it was almost like we'd gone back in time and we were still towards the back end of the 2017 season. Mm. You know, all the things that they said they were going to do during the offseason, which was they were going to recommit to the running game. They were going to, I think at one point Schottenheimer said in a press conference that they were going to run the ball even when the opponent knew they were going to run the ball, and then they get a third and inches play and they throw the ball. I mean, they contradicted themselves so much. It just looked like, you know, the end of the first half, 18 passes to six runs. Yeah. By the end of the game, they'd had 33 pass attempts plus the six sacks, which you can call pass attempts as well. So that's 39 technically pass attempts compared to just the 16 runs. They'd not made really much of an attempt to establish the running game. Chris Carson looked really good, but they wasted time splitting carries for the sake of it. I mean, all of the things that they said they were going to do, they didn't. And the other disappointing thing you were talking about, Wilson, there was he looked at preseason to me. I don't know what you guys thought. Like, he was ready to take the next step. That he was he was preparing himself for a great start to the season. And yet the game begins, he didn't trust his reads. No. He didn't trust his protection. He looked jittery. He was feeling pressure that wasn't there. There were clean pockets. You know, practically the first snap of the game, he got some good protection, but he ran himself into a sack. He put himself into pressure, and it was Wilson. I don't want to go over the top, but that's kind of Wilson at his most frustrating when he was doing that. And it was a difficult game to watch. And I sincerely hope that next week, and it's going to be tough against Khalil Mack, that we don't see that Russell Wilson again.
Yeah, I think there's also occasions. I think there's when he had a third and two and it ended up being a fourth and 23 and something like that. And then Michael Dixon kicked us out of a bit of a tough situation. It seems Mike Dugard brought this up on Hawkblogger podcast earlier in the week, where it seems that teams are starting to defend against the double pirouette axle into the backfield, aren't they, Adam?
Yeah, and I guess, you know, grass field, away game, it was sort of all the kind of things that you in advance are nervous about. And I guess, you know, as I just briefly touched on with Rob before we started the show, we've been pretty negative for the majority of the offseason, unfortunately. We probably saw this coming, and yet I still feel really flat about what I watched, because as much as you can sort of tell yourself, oh, maybe it's not going to be, you know, we're not going to be great, the point of being a fan, I guess, is that there's always the hope that tomorrow will be better. And it was just really deflating by the end to see that happen. And actually, it was, we'll go on to defense as well, but once Tyler Lockett scored, I thought, you know what? We've got ourselves out of this one. They're not going to win this. The Broncos aren't good enough to come back. And sort of to lose it again, and then the drives at the end, I think we had what, like 11 plays and gained about 6 yards or something on the last two or three drives we had. It was just very, I felt very flat by the end of the game. Just the last sort of vindication I wanted was just to see how that transpired. I really felt very, very flat.
Yeah, it was just a case of go for the motions. I mean, that, I think I text you, imagine that final drive this week against Chicago, and it's at 5 o'clock in the morning. I mean, that's just, that'd be double the frustration with just time zone difference. On to the running game. Chris Carson and Rashad Penny split the ball, split the carries, but did very different things. Rashad Penny finished with 7 rush attempts for 8 yards, somehow with a longest of 5, and Chris Carson with 7 rushes for 51 yards, longest of 24, which is the one where he managed to clean hurdle Bradley Roby, I think it was. The split carries, I mean, another thing Shot and I said over the training camp, Rob, was that you were going to go with a hot hand.
Obviously, what you're saying there about the running back going with a hot hand is exactly what they were saying in the offseason, that that's what they were going to do. And they didn't do that. You know, they made a point of splitting the carries between Carson and Penny, even though one player, Penny, clearly looked rusty and the other player looked very effective. And I actually went back and had a look, because I wanted to have a look at what was said after the 2016 season and what was said after the 2017 season, because this performance in general felt very familiar to me. It felt like I was watching a continuation of the last two seasons, some of the issues that we talked about and saw there, just continuing into 2018. So I wanted to go back and see what was said after each season. And after the 2016 season, I wrote this on the blog, talking about the running game, that the Seahawks had the 25th best running attack in the NFL this year. In the previous 4 years, they were comfortably in the top 5. I spent a bit of time talking about how difficult it was proving to be to replace Marshawn Lynch. I mean, I talked when Lynch was playing, I used to write about that will be the toughest thing that John Schneider and Pete Carroll ever have to do, is replace Marshawn Lynch, the impact that he had on the team, in the locker room, and also on the field. And that's proven to be absolutely the case. But it doesn't mean they can't run the ball successfully without Lynch, because many teams do. But it feels like they needed to recommit to the run after 2016. That's what I wrote there. It feels like they need to recommit to that aspect of their offense. They spent all of that offseason talking about how they wanted to be the bully again, that they wanted to recommit to the run. It didn't happen last year. The run game was terrible. It was as worse as it's ever been. And then at the end of last season, they talked about recommitting to the run. They drafted a running back in the first round. They drafted 2 blocking tight ends to replace Jimmy Graham. They changed the offensive coordinator to a guy who's known for running the ball. And they changed the offensive line coach. All of the things that they did in the offseason were set up to recommit to the run. And then the game actually happens against Denver, and they didn't do it. And if you're going to be a team that passes to set up the run, that's fine. But say that that's what you're going to be, or don't talk about being a run-focused team. Just have an offense. But they talk constantly about the run, which is why people like me end up complaining when they don't try and properly, in my opinion, establish the running game, because they're saying this is what our vision is for the offense, and then they seem to do something else. And I don't think that saying we didn't get enough first downs, we didn't pass enough for enough first downs to actually get the run game going, actually, I don't think that connects. I don't think that makes sense. If you want to run and you say you're going to run, then run. I think it's as simple as that. Make sure that you're running the ball. If that's who you want, that's what you want your identity to be.
Yeah. And out of interest, do you want them to run? Take the comments of the summer out. You know, if you blank canvas, you can build your own Seahawk offense. Would you want them to do that? Because I feel like I'm getting a bit sucked in by some of the stuff I'm reading, but there is some quite compelling stuff about the run. And I do wonder about the validity of some of the stuff that maybe running isn't the best way, and it's almost slightly archaic the way that they are trying to set the team up.
I think it really depends what you've got. Because if you've got Aaron Rodgers or you've got Tom Brady, I don't think the run game matters that much. Because a lot of the run plays, you know, the ways that other teams will find success on, you know, shorter yardage gains, Aaron Rodgers and Tom Brady will do that with short passing. And they can still beat you over the top and do all the other stuff. You know, their passing games are on a different level. And I think that there are other teams that do need the run. They need the run to set up play action, and they need the run to support their quarterbacks because they aren't Brady or Rodgers. And you definitely see that. I mean, look how much New Orleans benefited last year from running the ball, even though they are traditionally a pass-centric offense. You know, and there are teams that I think do need the run, and I think the Seahawks need the run as part of their offense. I think Russell Wilson's at his best when he is doing some play action. I think when there's a threat of to run, or that Russell can run or use his legs, you know, I think that is needed. Russell Wilson's never going to be a stand tall in the pocket, throw it 40 times quarterback. He can throw 40 times and he can win playing that way, but he's just not. I mean, we saw it in the game at the weekend. He gets jittery in the pocket. He senses pressure a bit too much sometimes. I think he needs to run, get a bit of play action, suck those defensive linemen into the running game sometimes, and then he can throw deep, and he's one of the best deep throwers in the league. So I do think that the Seahawks offense needs to be able to run the ball. If you were saying to me, Rob, you're now the GM of a football team, how would you set up your team? I'd be open to it. I'd play to the personnel that I've got. If you handed me Aaron Rodgers or Tom Brady, I'd set up the offense the way that Green Bay and New England set up their offenses. If you hand me Russell Wilson, I'll set up. I might be more inclined to set up with the Seahawks. My biggest complaint is that if you're going to say you're going to run as a feature, do it. Mm-hmm. And I don't. And I think there's been in that game against Denver, it contradicted what they said they were going to do. And I think we've seen too much of that in the last two seasons. And I'm interested. I'm so eager to see the Chicago game. I want to play it now because I want to see if that was just a one off. Yeah. Or whether we're going to see the kind of offense that we expected to see in week two.
Yeah, I think Brandon Marshall was the only Seahawks receiver who caught a pass which resulted in a first down all game on Sunday. With Rashad Penny, just quickly, are they going to back themselves into a bit of a corner with him if they're going to keep doing this and there's such a massive gap in production and how they obviously look as well? Are they in danger of, I don't say 1 week, are they in danger of pushing themselves into a bit of a corner with this?
Well, they could be. Because they've drafted him in the first round and they want to use him, and I think he is a talented player. And I think, in fairness, looking back on their decision to draft him in the first round, because people are going to dissect that to death, while Carson continues to look great and Penny doesn't necessarily, I think there's two things to remember there. One, it was that in that sort of range where the Seahawks were drafting, running back was the value position. That's where and if you wanted one, you had to take one in that range. We saw, I think, was it 6 or 7 go in the first 50 picks. If you wanted one, you were taking one there. And the Seahawks, they saw the value and they wanted one because they didn't want to go into the season with an injury, and someone who's had a lot of injuries, Chris Carson, someone who's had a lot of injuries, CJ Prosize and Mike Davis. So they wanted to take one. That's fine. I get it. They didn't want a free agent. It didn't work with Eddie Lacy, so they wanted to draft one. I get that decision. But the problem they've got now is that they've drafted a guy and the best running back on the roster is a 7th-round pick. And justifying that pick, it has to play a part. As much as you say it's about competition and stuff like that, it has to. Surely it has to. I cannot imagine Pete Carroll standing there going, now, you know, we're going to make him inactive this week because Mike Davis and Chris Carson are the two that are most effective at the moment. I think they've got, there's almost a duty there to get him warmed up and get him involved. So, I mean, personally, you know, I'd be quite happy to see Chris Carson carry the ball 20 to 25 times in this next game. Whether that happens or not remains to be seen.
Yeah. Moving on to the receiving core, before we get to the bit of the depressing side of it, Will Disley, fourth round pick this past April's draft, became the first tight end to have 100 yards receiving in his first game since 1968. Will Disley, in his collegiate career at Washington, only had 336 receiving yards at UW. Another thing, we spent all summer hearing one thing, and in week one we see a different thing. I mean, his hands are ridiculously soft. Did you see this coming, Rob, with Disley breaking out so early and so explosively in week one?
No, I didn't. I didn't see that at all. And it was one of the few positives. I think that the positives were probably Earl Thomas, Will Disley, and the punter. And that was it. And the funny thing is that you guys have read some of the stuff I've done, and we've talked many times before. I am very positive about the Seahawks. I don't go looking for negatives, and will never go over I'd like to think I don't go over the top with being negative for the sake of it. I feel like if we're going to talk about negatives, it's with due course, and it's within reason. And a few people on the blog have said this week, and I think it's been quite funny actually, can we concentrate on the positives, which are Will Disley and Michael Dixon? And my response to an extent has been, with the greatest respect, I don't feel in the mood to talk about a rookie tight end right now, because though if they're the positives, then you've got a problem.
Yeah,
but it's funny to keep touching that. I mean, I think Stu and I, much to the chagrin of quite a few people, certainly our podcast friends in America, I mean, we kind of saw 6-10 as a rough idea of a record by the end of the season. And again, it was annoying to sort of feel like maybe that's come true, because obviously being a fan is all about hope. But one of the reasons I wanted to speak this week was that you are not normally incredibly positive, not negative. You know, that's not a criticism. You're positive, and it's great to read it. And sometimes when you're a negative fan, it's nice to see the other side of the coin and think, oh yeah, actually, he's right. That's a reason to be optimistic. Have your views on the season in general changed from Sunday, even though as fans we probably shouldn't do that after week one?
They've changed a little bit. I mean, I did say before the first game that I thought 7, 8, 9 wins was kind of and I thought that if they were going to get to 9, it's because Russell Wilson was going to have a really good year here. And in fairness to him, last year, he carried the Seahawks in a lot of games last year, and they could have easily won 10 games. I mean, look at the last game against Arizona, for example. I mean, that should have been a win. So that could have easily been 10. And I think Wilson is a good enough quarterback that he could elevate the team to. But I also felt like if they were going to get to sort of 9, 10 wins, they were going to have to win these tight games, the ones that are eminently winnable, that could go either way, which is what essentially this was, because the Seahawks are winning by 4 points in the fourth quarter. They would have to find a way to win many of those games, and they were going to lose games. I think they'll lose to the Rams twice, for example, but I think the close ones they're going to have to win. So my estimate was 7, 8, 9. So today I don't really feel any different. I'm probably more towards 7 than the 9 wins right now. But that's kind of where I felt they were. And I think it really comes down to Wilson and the offense's ability to show a lot more than they did at the weekend. But the fact that they didn't, and it looked a lot like, I don't want to be overly negative about it, but it looked a lot like some of the football we saw in 2017, makes me think that, 7 wins, and you look at the schedule as well. It's hard to sort of pick out where the big chunk of wins are going to come from, unless they get lucky late on and Aaron Rodgers' knee injury is bad, and the Lions are hopeless, which they may well be, and one or two other teams really collapse. You expect to be strong.
I'd agree. The depressing part of the receiving core, though, was Doug Baldwin played just on 11 snaps on Sunday before his other knee, that he'd the opposite knee to the one he'd nursed through preseason. And he suffered I'm not sure the grade or the severity, an MCL tear, which Pete Carroll says is going to keep him out for at least a couple of weeks. I put on Twitter, Rob, that Doug Baldwin is probably the defensive player after Wilson that we could not do without. And when you talk about confidence and where the wins could have come from. It's a harder offense to see being productive without number 89 on the outside and with everything that he brings to the table on field and on the sideline.
Yeah, absolutely. And we know we talked a little bit earlier about Wilson not necessarily trusting his reads.
Yeah.
And one of the few people in this in the receiving group that he's got that trust and that long-term relationship with is Doug Baldwin. And on a third down, he knows where Doug Baldwin's going to be. He can throw to a region, even if he can't see over the big offensive lineman, which has become a big talking point again after the game on Sunday, that he knows where Doug Baldwin's going to be. He can throw to a range and into a window. And he knows that Doug Baldwin's going to make those plays because they've done it year after year after year. Yeah. He is not there yet with Jaron Brown. He's not there yet with Brandon Marshall. I don't think he's there with David Moore. Keenan Reynolds has just been called up. He isn't going to be there with Keenan Reynolds, even though they seem to have a bit of chemistry during the preseason. And then there's Tyler Lockett. But can Tyler Lockett be that third down receiver? Well, I'm not necessarily sure that he can. I think he's more of a red line receiver and a deep ball threat. So it is a concern. It is a problem. And all the more reason to try and make sure that this running game is a lot better than it was on Sunday.
Yeah. Adam, Doug Baldwin?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny what you're talking about, the win count. I've kind of took the view that there's five teams that will win 12 games that you can sort of hang your hat on, five teams that will win four or five games you can hang your hat on, and the rest will probably be 8-8, and it's the number of stars in the team that take the 8-8 to 6-10 or 10-6, if that makes sense. And losing Doug Baldwin for a long period of time, I just look at that team and think, where are the stars? And from Sunday especially, I was looking at thinking, you know, if there was maybe one more star on offense, one more star on defense in the second half, we'd probably have won that comfortably. I mean, Bradley McDougal had a really good game. He's probably worth a mention at some point. But losing Baldwin, who's the real star of that offense outside of Wilson, you do one worry, especially in someone like Chicago, New York, Khalil Mack probably wreaking havoc. A tough place to go. You just wonder if how that's going to hold up. I mean, Brandon Marshall, fantastic effort from him, but is his body going to hold up for 16 games of that sort of level? I'm not really convinced it is, sadly.
No, I mean, we said the first one we did the preseason, and we didn't think he was going to make the team. And now
we thought it was a classic camp cut, we called it.
Yeah, and now he's probably, arguably, WR1 going into the second week of the season. Before we move on to the defense, Rob, Jermaine Fedi, as always, has come in for a lot of flack, possibly some of it on some snaps deserved, but, I mean, We Von Miller is not a new entity in this league. He's not a new thing. His talent and his how he abuses much better right tackles or tackles compared to Jermaine Ifedi is well known. Is there a case of arrogance from the coaching staff that they didn't give him more help or give anyone more help on that side of the line to try and stop Von Miller earlier? And even when he did get one or two sacks, they just didn't. They just seem to carry on regardless. Is there a case of a bit of arrogance from the coaching staff with that?
I wouldn't say necessarily arrogance. I mean, they did give Ifedi some help at times. I don't think you can do that every snap, because if you do, you're basically taking a player out of your offense to be a second right tackle. So and in that instance, you might as well just put put a tackle on. You might as well just have George Fant stood next to Jermaine Ifedi and I've done.
Postage is playing, that may not be the worst idea in the world. Yeah, to be honest. Well,
possibly true. You know, maybe they need to against Khalil Mack next week, the way he's playing as well. So, yeah, I don't think it was arrogance. I just feel that I think you've got to give Von Miller. This is the thing that frustrates me a little bit with Ifedi. No one ever seems to give the defensive ends any credit. No. And when it was Ingram for the Chargers, everyone was going, "Oh, do you know what? What a terrible job Ifedi did there." And I thought, did you just see what Ingram's just done? I mean, he's one of the best defensive ends in the league. He's coming up against the right tackle who, admittedly, he's not one of the best right tackles in the league, and he bossed him. Yeah. You know, if you put Doug Baldwin against one of the weaker slot receivers, slot corners in the NFL, I'd expect Doug Baldwin to win that battle. I mean, that's just the way it is. And, you know, Von Miller's going to be a Hall of Famer one day. And one of the, I thought it was amazing that he did. Did you see how wide his stance was?
Amazing.
He basically gave himself another 20% work to do to get to the quarterback. But he did it because, one, he's so quick, and two, because Russell Wilson was their game plan. Fair play to Vance Joseph. I think he's going to cost Denver some games this year because I don't think he's the best head coach. But they decided, stay wide, take a longer arc to the QB. It will I think you saw one snap that Bradley Chubb stunted inside and Dwayne Brown completely left him. No one talked about that, by the way. No. And Dwayne Brown let him run on the inside and Chubb then flushed Wilson out the pocket. And then Von Miller, just because of the arc that he took and the wider stance, just ran straight into Von Miller. It was perfectly executed by Denver. The inside stunt from Chubb, the inside move from Chubb, and the wide arc from Von Miller completely took that play out of it. And it wasn't because Jermaine Ifedi necessarily was beat 1v1. It was clever from Denver, and it was the talent and the speed of Von Miller. And I think you take your hat off to Von Miller. I wish the Seahawks had somebody like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think last year was his lowest sack total in his career. I think he still managed to get 10 or 11, I think he did last year. So yeah, he's one of the top three, top five pass rushers in the league. Ifedi, Adam?
I mean, what is there left to say? Like, I feel a bit sorry for the bloke because he's obviously not necessarily up to the task. But, you know, there'll be a lot more on Seahawk Twitter later when we get to the proverbial bin segment of this podcast. But, like, how much more moaning can people actually be bothered to do with Ifedi? Like, he's just not great. I don't see what anyone's gaining by trying to make the hot take about Jermaine Ifedi on every single play, because he is what we know he is, isn't he?
Yeah, was it Dennis Allen said they are what we thought they were? Wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, am I wrong there, Rob? I mean, I don't really know what... Were we expecting anything else from Ifedi particularly? Especially against a guy, you know, you're right to talk about the defensive players. We love Michael Bennett, not because of the offensive lineman he played against, but because he was really good as a Seahawk. So sometimes you just say, well played, Von Miller, and Jermaine Ifedi is just not that great.
Yeah, I think that this is year three. And Jermaine Ifedi is not taking the kind of steps forward where you would say with any confidence that by the end of the year, you would feel like he's somebody that you want to extend his contracts or make a long-term feature of this team. That's just a fact. But that said, I think if you watch a lot of the other teams, I mean, the Detroit Lions have spent more than possibly anybody but Dallas on their offensive line. Yeah. And their offensive line is terrible, you know, across the board. And they've made a major feature of trying to repair that line. And I think it's just another review of how tough teams are finding it to get good offensive linemen into the league. They just aren't out there. And, for Jermaine Ifedi, I don't think there is much left to say. But I will certainly say this, that people need to have a look at the other side, because Dwayne Brown gives up some plays too. And he often doesn't get any criticism, and Jermaine Ifedi seems to get it all.
Yeah, and also J.R. Sweezy with a needless hole which negated like a 50-yard play, and no one seemed to mention that. And also Eric Flowers still does exist, where I think on one play on Sunday he got beat and just tripped the pass rusher up instead of even trying.
That was amazing.
Oh, yeah. That's great.
That was amazing.
Yeah, defensive side of the ball, we'll go from front to back. Pass rush, as we said earlier, we kind of expected not a lot, and they didn't bring a lot, Adam.
No, I mean, it's kind of what we were saying, that in the offseason, you know, fantastic story that Deion Jordan is now probably like a starting guy who we're expecting to get to the quarterback. But, I mean, really? Like, that's a lot to ask of a guy that's barely put, like, two good games in his career together, as much as he's got the physical attributes to potentially be great. And, you know, Frank Clark is the best that we've got, and I think people get slightly carried away by how quickly he's heralded as a guy that needs to get like enormous money. I think we probably need to see a bit more from Frank Clark. As we said over the offseason, he got a really good sack, and he obviously is playing with a bit of an injury. But I don't think there's, you know, would you guys be gutted if Frank Clark left in the summer?
Not particularly, to be honest.
Rob?
It depends.
I mean, bear in mind, it would leave us so short, but... Yeah. I'm just talking about, you're the GM, he is just a player X, well, and another player comes in. Would you be gutted?
No, I wouldn't be gutted, but if he signs a one-year deal with the Minnesota Vikings for $8 million, then yes.
Touché.
Yeah. Well, talking of interior, obviously, Philip Lindsay, talking about rookie running backs, not doing a lot there. Rookie running backs both went 15 carries, 71 yards, and also Philip Lindsay caught a touchdown as well. But undrafted from Colorado and Royce Freeman from Oregon, they really did enough. And as we said about the Seahawks converting third downs, that is all that the Broncos offense really needed and got from their two young pups at running back, Rob.
Yeah, do you know, I find it strange now when you watch other teams run for this thing called a 100-yard game. You know, it was 64-yard rushing performance by the Seahawks. You know, you remember the days when you used to have 200 yards rushing with Marshawn Lynch and Russell and all the rest, and and now a 64-yard game is a hard-earned result for the Seahawks. Yeah, I find confusing at the moment. But a year ago, they spent their first pick on Malik McDowell, so they obviously felt we need a really good interior defensive lineman. And then obviously he was unavailable, so they went and traded another second round pick for Sheldon Richardson, because that was such an important position for them. They had to spend 2 second round picks on defensive tackles. And then by the end of the 2017 season, McDowell's practically retired. They let Sheldon Richardson walk for a 1 year, $8 million contract. They've wasted 2 second round picks, and they kind of just bring in a bunch of guys.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, how could it be so important 1 year to have, you know, a big splash at interior defensive line, and then the following year just say, we're going to get on with it? And the thing that stood out to me a little bit was that it felt a bit like we were watching a Diet Coke version or a Coke Zero version of what they had in 2011, 2012, which was that they'd have the base defensive line, which is basically all the big guys with Red Bryant and the rest. And then opponents would go, well, they're not going to rush the pass. They just want to stop the run. So we'll pass. And then on the passing downs, they bring out the package with Bruce Irvin in it, for example, or all the speed, and they put that out there. And the Seahawks were kind of just showing the hand a little bit, and they went away from that after they won the Super Bowl, because then obviously Michael Bennett and Cliff Avril could play a lot of snaps, and they could both defend the run and the pass pretty well. They've got a bit more sort of speed inside as well. And at the moment, it just looks a bit like, you know what they're going to do. You know, in the early downs, it's there's no pass rush at all. They're just going to try and stop the run, and then later on, they're going to. It's quite easy to game plan around that. And I'm just, I hope that the defensive line shows more, but it just seems really, really underwhelming in every aspect.
Yeah. Well, while Russell Wilson was sacked for six times, 56 yards, Case Keenum was brought to the floor just the once and lost 5 yards. I mean, 51 yards is a big deal in a game with a 3-point game. Adam, defensive line, interior, it was not up to it on Sunday, really, was it?
No, I was a little bit worried against the Chargers in preseason. I think Rivers had maybe one or two drives, and it just seemed very, very easy for him to move the ball and just move the chains. And I know you can't glean much from preseason, but ultimately, you know, people have made a big deal of, like, oh, this is where the Seahawks want to be, you know, a group of unproven guys who, you know, are being not heralded and being criticized, and they're not rated. But ultimately, 2012 doesn't always happen, and sometimes you're just not that great. And I just wonder that this year, we just might have left us a little bit short. I mean, you trade Michael Bennett for, I guess, personal reasons, which, you know, is their right to do, is their team. But again, someone you just let walk out the door and haven't really replaced. And it could be, when Rob, I think your blog title was a long old season. I think if it's going to be a long old season anywhere, the defensive line probably is the embodiment of that.
Yes, I would agree. And they just created very little pressure. Yeah, you know, Case Keenum got the ball out quite quickly, but there were some very noticeable plays where you just thought, your eyes are, when you're watching your team on defense, your eyes are drawn to the defensive line, aren't you? You're kind of hoping that they're going to create some pressure, get into the backfield.
It's exciting.
I was watching it and I was just thinking, there's nothing. There's just no penetration. There's nothing. There's no pressure at all. There was the one sack from Frank Clark, which I think came on a stunt. Yeah. You know, there was no one was beating a man. And it was particularly difficult to watch, given that the day before I'd just watched the Clemson defensive line absolutely decimate Texas A&M. It was like from one extreme to the other. The four defensive linemen are all going to go in the first round, by the way, next year.
Yeah.
Just took it in turns to have a great play. It was like on every single down, it was, that's Christian Wilkins' turn to have a play. And then it's Cleland Ferrell's, it's Dexter Lawrence, and then it's Austin Bryant. And then when you watch the Seahawks, it was they took it in turns to just get well blocked out of the play in a 1v1. So it's worrying. I think it's the biggest sign. It's completely that they're in a reset year, because they didn't even go anywhere near the Khalil Mack possibility. They've not really done much. I mean, even Eric Walden didn't survive. And they've got what they've got. They've got one pass rusher, which is Frank Clark. They've got Deion Jordan, who's a complete unknown and will do well to stay healthy. And then there's Rasheem Green, who we all keep our fingers crossed that he's going to really develop into something, but he's still a third round rookie. And rookie defensive linemen have generally not had the biggest impact under Pete Carroll. You think back to Frank Clark's first year, you know, he had a great preseason just like Green, and then didn't really seem to do that much at all as a rookie, apart from that one game in Minnesota. So, it's a concern, and there's going to be some very, very long days, I think, against some good quarterbacks down the road.
I can't help but wonder this, and sorry, Stu, I'm just sort of picking up on the Schneider stuff that we were briefly WhatsApping about. I'm looking at the team, and there's almost a full salary cap currently used up, and I know a lot of that is down to dead money, which, you know, is not really accountable for, but I kind of feel that we've lost all of the players that we might have been able to get anything back for, and I'm looking at the team now, and we've sort of got nothing back for it, and it just worries me slightly that this rebuild might take a little bit longer than necessary, whereas if they'd had a complete sort of clear house and accept that maybe this year wasn't going to be the one, which I know is not necessarily their MO at all, I just wonder if this rebuild might end up taking a little bit longer than necessary because I don't know, we're sort of in a bit of a halfway house at the minute.
Yep. It's absolutely true. I mean, here's the thing. They waited and waited and waited, and last year was a very aggressive one last go with the old band, wasn't it? That's the Sheldon Richardson trade was evidence of that. They wanted to win the Super Bowl last year with the old group, probably knowing that big change was coming, and it was one last shot at a title, and it emphatically didn't work. And now they've lost everybody, as you've said, without getting any major draft stock, or there's never been any decent trades. They've not been able to get any value out of that. They're down on the picks.
Like, even a comp pick turns into Barkevious Mingo, which is just not exactly that. Why would you do that? Is my thinking.
Yeah, and Ed Dixon, and they must have known that that was going to happen. You know, they knew that. I mean, did they really expect that Luke Jokel was going to get picked up? Did they really expect that Eddie Lacy was going to get picked up that would balance those things out? So they let Jimmy Graham walk, get nothing for him. They let Sheldon Richardson walk, get nothing for him. You know, they've not been able to accumulate anything moving forward. And when you actually look at what they've got to spend, yeah, they've got some cap space, but then they have to make a big decision on whether they pay Russell Wilson down the line, and that will lead to a huge chunk of the free cap space that they've got. They've got, these are the picks they've got next year: first, third, fourth, fifth. That's it. They don't have a second, a sixth, or a seventh. And they're not going to get any comp picks unless they start cutting people. They have to cut Ed Dixon pretty much in the next few weeks. They're going to have to cut Shamar Stephen or Johnson and try and work that a little bit just to try and get some comp picks back. So that's not all lost there, but it's going that way. Mm. And they just don't have the means in the off season to go big. And that's a little bit why I was a bit surprised why they've been so... They seem to be... Do you know what the best thing to describe how they're in a halfway house? Is their determination to hold on to Earl Thomas and have him for one last year, because they seem to think that that will help them win.
Mm.
And yet their complete willingness, as far as I see it, to let him walk away for free in the off-season, which kind of...
I'd take a third now. And I know that's probably an awful thing to say, but what are we going to get otherwise? And we're not going to win the Super Bowl this year.
Yeah, and they've been offered a second, if you believe the reports. So what, you know, you don't have a second, you get a second rounder. And that's the thing, is it's that you're in a rebuild in one sense, that you've released Sherman, you've traded Bennett for peanuts, you've allowed Graham and Richardson and the other Richardson to leave, you've really sort of cleaned house in that regard, and yet one more year of Earl Thomas, because you just never know, we might win a title.
Yeah.
Bizarre.
Because Earl Thomas, I think you all agree, I think Earl Thomas is going to leave. I don't think there's any motivation there on Earl Thomas.
100%.
Or the Seahawks to get a new deal done. I think it's wishful thinking anybody does. Look, things
can
change.
And they're never going to franchise tag him, because that doesn't do anyone any favours either.
No, he will earn 12 million. People look at this franchise tag this year, you're actually guaranteed 120% of your current salary. So he will not get the franchise tag of the 5% or whatever it is, or the top five earners at safety. He will get it, I think it's $12 million next year, which the Seahawks are very evidently not willing to pay him. Otherwise, they would have done probably a 2 or 3 year extension at that kind of amount.
I mean, the funny thing is that, as I think Hawk Blogger picked up on in the week, you've got Trey Flowers starting at right cornerback, just because you didn't want to pay Richard Sherman what he was due.
Yeah.
Which, again, it's a weird one. And to be that willing to get rid of a guy, but then, yeah, you're just sort of a halfway housing it. You're not really committing to anything at the minute. And that's my worry, that we're going to end up like this for 2 or 3 years, when I think we probably all have taken one very bad year if it was patently obvious what the plan was. I mean, I certainly would have done.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, if they got a bunch of picks next year, let's say that they had, you know, a first, a couple of seconds, a load of comp picks, and they've got $100 million to spend in free agency and they cleaned house, then you could go into the offseason thinking, here, what an opportunity to reload. Like, you can definitely see that plan, and you'd expect them to be competitive again next year. But what they've actually got, a lot of expensive parts that, I mean, you know, if you get rid of Russell Wilson, then you're giving in. But then, you see, you're going to build around him and try and be competitive, but you haven't got the stock to actually be competitive. And as you say, Flowers at corner, Shaquem, bless him. I absolutely love what he did at UCF. I wrote many blogs. I think I even said, and this might this will resonate with you, is that I said that his performance against Auburn in the bowl game at the end of the year was the best individual sporting performance I've seen since David Beckham against Greece in getting England to the 2002 World Cup. You know, it was that amazing. But he is what he is. He's a nickel linebacker and a special teamer. And they're asking him to set the edge against the run. Can't do it. Didn't do it at UCF. Didn't do it on Sunday. They're asking him to drop in zone. Didn't do it for UCF. Couldn't do it. Struggled there. Struggled at the weekend. Was exposed. And the players that they brought in, the young players that they brought in to try and beat the next group, Flowers, Griffin, some of the safeties that they brought in, the defensive linemen, you look at it and you just think, I'm not getting the same vibe that I had in 2011.
No.
Well, how do you reckon it pans out with Russell Wilson, as we're sort of vaguely on the topic? Because Stu and I were talking about, you got the CBA in 2021. I kind of feel that you probably let the contract run down and franchise tag him for a year and then see what happens after that?
I think you have to. I mean, he's always been a quarterback that has relied a lot on his mobility, hasn't he? And you have to see, I mean, he's 30 this year, so you have to see how that's going to be impacted. It might not be at all, and he might actually take the next step that I was personally hoping he would do. I'm sure you were as well after watching his preseason. You know, it's one game in. Hopefully you can lead this team. And if so, you don't feel any concern paying him at all. But I think it just makes sense to, you've got this season, you've got next season, a franchise tag. And then after that, you've got a decision to make. Because then if you franchise him again, you're going to be paying him practically your whole salary cap. But if you feel like making him the highest paid player in the NFL at that point is it what you want to do, then you've got that option. I think it's in the balance. And I say that as someone who has argued constantly about Seahawks Twitter's obsession with Russell Wilson. And look, John Schneider happened to just glance in the general direction of Josh Allen during the preseason or the offseason. So that must mean that they're going to trade Russell Wilson. I've fought against that a lot. But you just got to be realistic about this. Russell Wilson's not 25 anymore. The quarterbacks are earning ridiculous amounts of money now. It's getting up to $30 million a year. It's a huge percentage of the cap. A lot of the teams that are having success are paying quarterbacks a lot lower salaries, and it's just a decision they're going to have to make. And in fairness to them, they've shown that they are willing to make big decisions. But it's one that I find very hard to. I can't get a feel either way. It's the conversation we'll have to have in about 8 months' time, isn't it?
Yeah. One more thing on Diff. We mentioned briefly earlier, Bradley McDougal with two interceptions. I mean, he's going to need to keep doing that with Earl Thomas still probably not with his legs completely under him, but it's an encouraging performance from a safety who's been asked to do different things that Cam was being asked to do the last couple of years, isn't he?
Yeah, definitely. Major positive. Great to see him playing well. I think that one thing that the picks showed me at the weekend was that teams are going to try and test this defense more than they did in the past. And that's going to be a good thing. So the turnovers were going down every year because teams were unwilling to take chances. A lot of it, they found a way to work Seattle, perhaps a short passing game, less risk, frustrated that defense. Now, I think they're going to take some shots, and that's going to lead to interceptions. It's going to lead to opportunities. Cam, as amazing as he was probably not as good as Bradley McDougal in those sort of situations to make those opportunistic picks. And two to start the season, great start for him. Let's see if he can go and get five or six this year, because the teams are going to take opportunities. Earl Thomas has got great chance for Earl Thomas if he wants to get paid in the offseason to get more picks than he's had in a few years as well. Can I just mention one quick thing, and I hate to bring up another negative thing.
Because this is a podcast for that, Rob.
It's a safe house.
But it kind of feels like while we're in this zone, let's just get it all out there.
Yeah.
Immediately after the 2016 season, as I said, I've been a bit of a sad act this week and looking back at what we wrote about after that season. And Pete Carroll came out in his press conference and listed the priorities for the offseason. And he talks about cornerback, needed some new cornerback depth there. The draft was set up for that. Need to get the offensive line working again. And he talked about linebackers. And this is it. This is the quote. I've got it here. It says, "We need some youth at the linebacker spot now. Bobby and KJ played thousands of plays this year between the two of them and were extremely successful, but we need to address that. We didn't really get anybody that made a difference in the last couple of years that can really fight to take those guys' jobs. Think if somebody could battle KJ and Bobby for their starting jobs. That's what we need to draft towards, so we will be looking there." The Seahawks didn't draft a single linebacker in the subsequent draft in 2017. And they drafted Shaquem Griffin in this draft. What changed? Why was Pete Carroll talking about we need to draft as a priority depth behind Bobby and KJ? And he talked about competition there, but really what he means is if either of these guys are out because they're playing thousands and thousands and thousands of snaps, we need somebody who can step in. And we've seen how badly the Seahawks struggle when either one of KJ Wright or Bobby Wagner's out there or not healthy, as we saw against the Rams at the back end of last season when Bobby played and he was about 25% healthy. Mm-hmm. So we see again at the weekend, KJ's out. He's going to miss some time. He may miss the next game. Shaquem's exposed. They bring in Calitro. He has a decent preseason. But, you know, that's not really addressing that. You know, they've not drafted anybody. They've not invested a pick in the first three rounds on a linebacker. They've not gone out and picked someone up in free agency that you go, right, okay, you know, that's a Will or a Mike there who, if these guys need a break in the game, they can come in. Or if one of them's missing a week, we feel comfortable with that. I'm not talking about the Sam. You know, I know they drafted Jacob Martin and I know they got Mingo, but they're Sams. They're sort of Sam Leo types. Yeah. We're talking about Mike and Will here. And I just wonder, I'd love to ask Pete Carroll, why was that a priority after the 2016 season? And why haven't the team been able to do anything about it in two off-seasons since?
Do you think, and it might be something, do you think it's something where the team, it's a stupid thing to be if it is. Do you think it's a thing where the team would like, are scared to step on certain people's toes? I mean, we've seen it with, well, the front end of all the Kaepernick stuff. We didn't see it until 2017 with Shaquem Griffin to like really challenge, if it is such a thing, Richard Sherman. And as you said, we haven't seen it with Bobby Wagner. We haven't really seen it with Earl Thomas because obviously you can't really imitate Earl Thomas. You think it is a case where there's certain players that go above the always compete thing, and it's just that they don't want to alienate. I don't know if that's the right word, but do you think that could carry some weight?
I don't. I think I've got a couple of things that I think Pete Carroll might answer that question with. And I think if they could have drafted a linebacker, they definitely would have done, because KJ's contract's up at the end of the season as well. And if they're on a mission to not pay anybody third contracts, there's at least a half a chance that he's going to be leaving as well with Earl Thomas in the offseason. I mean, he's not signed a new deal. And Tyler Lockett's done a deal, Dwayne Brown's done a deal, KJ's not. So they may be thinking, he's of a certain age, third contract, we're going to move on. That could easily happen. And if that happens, they're going to have to find somebody. There's a priority to fill that spot. So I think they'd have been very willing to draft somebody or sign somebody who could potentially be a long-term replacement there. I think what it possibly is that maybe too many other needs have emerged. Like, they probably didn't expect the running game to be as bad as it was last year, and they probably felt that had to then be an absolute priority in the off-season, and that maybe drew their attention. They drafted running back first in the first pick. They didn't have a second-round pick because they traded that for Sheldon Richardson. And then in the third round, they needed a pass rusher, so ultimately the opportunity's gone there. I guess in 2016, you could argue the linebacker group wasn't amazing. There were some decent players that, you know, didn't fit the physical profile that they've drafted for the linebacker spot. Maybe they were a bit too focused on that. There were some decent ones in the 2017 draft, but again, did they really kind of fit?
Did they not pass on Reuben Foster?
And Miles Jack.
Reuben Foster, Miles Jack, Leighton Van Der Esch.
And I know you could argue character concerns, but they took Malik McDowell in that draft, so I'm struggling to necessarily, you know, fully defend them on those picks, you know, for two almost guaranteed home run players on the field.
It's a good point. And the year that he was in the draft, that was the draft that they'd said, we need a linebacker. Yeah. So unless they were just completely sold on, we need to have Malik McDowell, we've got to have that interior pass rusher, then fine. But, you know, it's a great point. They passed on linebackers, and here we are. And it is an issue. You know, they rely very much on KJ Wright and Bobby Wagner. And as soon as one of them goes out, you know, we were talking about the running run defense earlier. KJ played a part in that. A tight end was turning the court, you know, turning Shaquem Griffin. And it's the same. I mean, I said to my wife after the, you know, I was boring her. She doesn't care about football.
Yeah, she must have loved this.
You know, I just had
my wife ages go by. She'll love this.
And one day, I will just turn around and bore her for half an hour on the game, and she just pretends to listen. But I said to her, look, if I'm not disrespecting Shaquem. I love the guy, right? But having one hand is an issue here when setting the run. Because if you try to block a tight end with one hand and he gets two hands on you, he's winning. Mm-hmm. And that's the point. I said to my wife, I says, if I try and block you with one hand now, I'm 13 and a half stone. She's, what, about 7 stone. But if you try and push me out of the way with two hands, you'll win because you've got the leverage. And that's going to be an issue for him trying to set the edge against the run. And a tight end quite easily maneuvered him in that situation. Yeah. And I worry that that's going to be a situation that he's never going to be able to address necessarily. I just don't think he is, which is why I think he's better rushing the passer and getting after it and getting his head down. And he's great as a spy and he's great rushing the passer, but setting the edge. And that it could have cost him on Sunday. I've not studied the tape, so I can't say if it was a major issue or not. And Caledro played a lot of snaps anyway. But that is a position where they said they wanted to draft some depth. They haven't done. I'll be very interested to find out if and why that was the case.
Yeah.
The Griffin thing, sorry, Stu, it almost feels a bit like a roundabout sort of Jimmy Graham type thing where you know what a guy can do and what he can't do, and yet for some reason you sort of ignore all that common wisdom.
Yes, it is. And, you know, I'm not talking about anything with hindsight here. You know, these are all things that, I wasn't the only one. I wrote a great positive piece about Shaquem and how great he was as a, what an inspirational player and what a good player he is, and all of the positive things that he did, with the caveat that don't expect him to set the edge against the run and don't expect him to be particularly great in zone coverage early in his career. That's something he's going to have to learn. And those were the things that showed up. Sorry to say it, but those are the things that showed up in that game.
Yeah, and I think Pete Carroll may have said yesterday that Caledro will be the first and second down linebacker this week in Chicago as well, so it's obviously something that they're looking to correct and maybe slow things down for Shaquem.
Get him screaming off the edge. Yeah. They've got a pass rush issue. He can do that. Get him screaming off the edge on third down.
So obviously with all that said, the one of the biggest annoyances from this game, I think I messaged this to Adam halfway through, is that this Denver team were equally bad, if not worse, than the Seahawks team, weren't they, Adam?
I honestly, as soon as Lockett scored, I thought we've done it. I think I tweeted out like the Broncos are so bad that I think they'll give us this game because they're not going to be able to recover. And yeah, I guess in a way the referees sort of certainly had a hand in us not winning. But I really thought when we went up 24-20, I thought it was in the bag.
Yeah. Rob, it's not a great Broncos team, is it?
No, it's a bad Broncos team. I think they'll prove to be poorly coached during the year. I think Case Keenum has, in one game, has shown us that perhaps that was a bit of a flash in the pan last season. I mean, some of the interceptions that he threw were incredibly generous. But I had a slightly different feeling when the Lockett touchdown was scored, I have to admit. I mean, I get where you're coming from. I understand everybody who said that. A few people have said that they thought that was the game. And it was a four-point lead in a game.
And
where
I'm
Denver
the eternal pessimist.
Yeah, but there was a part of me that just thought, the way that this game's gone, Case Keenum is just going to saunter down the field with barely breaking a sweat, and they're just going to go back in front. And as that drive started to happen and became a reality, I was thinking in my mind, at least it's only 27-24. It's an absolute worst case scenario. I was already preparing myself for the worst, to think, well, it's only a 3-point deficit if they score, and if they're holding to a field goal, they're still in the lead. So I was thinking, yeah, do you know what? There's going to be every opportunity to go on and win this game, even if they score a touchdown. They did score the touchdown. It was very, very easy. And they had a couple of opportunities to try and go and win the game. And that last offensive series summed up. It was a beautiful portrait of my evening watching that game. Because it was just, and you two, I'm sure, felt the same way. Yeah. One pass, one fumble, one interception.
Yeah.
Go and put the kettle on. Don't put the kettle on.
I literally messaged Adam saying, imagine that at 5 o'clock next week. We'll finish on a bright spot, another bright spot. Michael Dixon, obviously a lot of talk about him over the summer since he was a fifth round pick, one that we traded up, and apparently the Broncos draft room laughed at that we traded ahead of him to take the Aussie punter. He punted the ball six times and an average of 59 yards, a long of 69, and he actually amassed more punt yards than the offense got in the game, 354 to 306. he was as advertised, but it, as you said at the start, Rob, it says a lot when you hang your hat a bit on the punter after a game.
Yeah, and you know, that's not to sort of throw any shade on what Dixon's doing. I mean, he is quite clearly a phenomenal player and a magician as a punter, and it's really exciting that he plays for the Seahawks and not somebody else, because if he was playing for somebody else, we'd all be wringing our hands right now going, why didn't the Seahawks draft him instead of sticking with a very aging John Ryan? So I think you have to give the Seahawks some credit. They've played a blinder with that particular draft pick, and if there's no reason to think that he can't be the Seahawks punter probably for many, many, many years, for as long as he wants to play, because he is the real deal. But, you know, again, you know, without wanting to be too negative about it, again, I want next week to be talking about great run game. Offensive line did better than expected against Khalil Mack. Russell Wilson really turned it on in a performance that puts that game in Denver to bed. I want to hear that the Seahawks are 1-1 on this road trip, so they go into a two winnable home games against Dallas and Arizona, feeling like they can actually get a bit of momentum into the season here, and we can feel a lot more positive. I don't want to be talking about the punter, but you know, we'll see.
I
will never ever care about a punter, to be honest. I mean, it's good to watch. Yeah, it's great to have a better one than a bad one. But I was wondering, looking at a couple of the more, I guess, embarrassing Russell Wilson sacks when he runs back and gets stuff for 11 yards. If you've got a punter that can kick that extra 15 yards back more than most guys can do, it almost felt worth Wilson taking the risk of trying to make something happen. I mean, this may be a completely ridiculous point that only comes out at midnight on a Wednesday evening, but I almost felt like, instead of throwing it away, if you've got a guy that you know can make up the sack yards, is it not worth trying to make a crazy double pirouette play if you're the quarterback?
Well, I think that you could go one step further and say, I think it's worth him trying to make the pirouette play, because we've seen him produce some absolute magic.
Yeah, also true.
I think it's always worth that to an extent. It's just, you don't always think that seconds after the sacks happen. You kind of think, oh my word, what was he doing there? But I think always worth a try. And yes, you know, I think it is, I think you're right. The punter's going to be a weapon this year. And he's going to, the Seahawks lost a lot of field position games. You know, the Rams game where they got absolutely hammered towards the end of the season, it felt like the Rams were starting on Seattle's 40-yard line every single drive they had, and it felt like the Seahawks were starting on their 1-yard line every time. And that was because the Seahawks punting game was poor and the Rams one was good, and the Rams got right on top of them straight away. And it feels like that could be there's going to be some games where the Seahawks give themselves a better chance of winning purely because they're starting on the 30 and the other team's starting on the 5. So I think it's a great pick. He's a great talent. I enjoying thoroughly watching him play. I just hope he doesn't have to punt too many times against Chicago.
Yeah, as we've trod over a lot of familiar ground from 2017, we won't talk too much about the kicker, but Dan Bailey still is an NFL player who's active and hasn't retired, right?
He's still out there.
I mean, we praised the decision of going to trade up for Michael Dixon. Seabass, at his age, with the injury he had last year, it could another one come back to bite them a bit, couldn't it, Adam?
I honestly thought when I saw that Dallas cut kicker Dan Bailey that they had two kickers called Dan Bailey. Because I couldn't believe that they would cut him. I presume it's a financial situation, and I think you said to me that a lot of teams will sort of do the Marcel Reese, let week one elapse and then try and scramble so you miss out on some of the veteran payments. But I couldn't believe it that he's still there. But then I was quite positive about Janikowski, because I have a view that when it comes to field goal kicking, it is 99% mindset. And if you've got the swagger that you're going to make it, you'll make it. And if you're like Blair Walsh, who's terrified, you won't make it. And I kind of thought, well, at least in Janikowski, anything within 48 will be money, and then that nonsense on Sunday goes and happens.
He gets the mulligan and just presses rewind and does it all again, doesn't he, Rob?
Very much like me playing golf, that.
the second kick was worse.
It wasn't a very enjoyable few hours. And then we'll move on to week two and talk about the Bears on Monday Night Football.
Yeah, and a difficult game because the Bears looked better than I think many people expected against Green Bay. But they're still the Bears, and that's the thing you've got to remember here. You know, they've got a second-year quarterback in Trubisky. They used a lot of magic tricks, didn't they? A lot of trick plays against the Green Bay. Had a lot of success with that. The Seahawks have got all of those on tape now, so unless they've got another 10 saved up the sleeve, the Seahawks can sort of work around that. I kind of feel like some of those gadgety things don't generally tend to work against the Seahawks. What works against the Seahawks tends to be the more, you know, the Philip Rivers style offense, the you know, very quick throws underneath, picking apart the coverage rather than trying to be too gimmicky. I think the Seahawks, the speed that they still do have, in fairness, on defense, will sort of nip some of that in the butt. I can't imagine Trubisky running round the edge and breaking off 20-yard runs against this defense. And if he does, he's just going to get absolutely smashed by Bobby Wagner. So I think that's one thing. They've got to try and stop the run. I think that could be more of a feature for Chicago this week. They have got a good running game. Their offensive line got a good press during the broadcast, but I don't think it's quite as good as they were saying on Sunday Night Football. And then it all comes down to Khalil Mack. And I guarantee now, and you'll probably agree, that Khalil Mack will get at least 2 sacks in this game. The big thing is to... Yeah, well, at least. I said at least. So it could be a lot more, but it'll get at least 2. It will get at least 2 sacks. The key thing is to make sure that when he gets those, it's not 5 or 6. And it's to make sure that the sacks are, you know, just things that are going to happen in the game. They're not fumbles. That he doesn't have a huge game-changing score or fumble that's returned for a touchdown. You know, just manage the fact that Khalil Mack's going to have his and that you're going to have to deal with that, because the rest of the Bears' defense is pretty good, but it's not amazing. Yeah. And they've played Vic Fangio defenses enough to know what they're going to expect.
Yeah, and also one thing on their offense outside the running back, when the Seahawks defense was good and when they were flying around the ball, speed killed opposing offenses, and they're going to face that with Tariq Cohen and how they may use him to help Trubisky, but he's someone they're going to have to kind of focus on in different ways to the way they have to focus on the Broncos running backs, Rob.
Yeah, and you know what, the thing about Cohen is that that's a great point, because he's the type of running back that they have a bit of an issue with. It's that running back who kind of just peels out and they lose him in coverage, and then all of a sudden he's got an easy first down, and they do give up a lot too many plays like that. In fairness to them, they adjust to it. I mean, there's been games where the running back for the opponent has had a really good game through the air. It's just sort of taken, you know, 3 or 4 catches and reeled off 40 yards in the first half, and then they take it away. So hopefully they're going to do that again, but he's an X factor. I like Howard. I like the way that he runs, and he's going to be tough to stop. He's just that physical between the tackles type runner that wears you down. And I hope the Seahawks do a bit of that. You know, I want to see the Seahawks running at the Bears. You know, that's one way. That's the other thing that was frustrating about the Denver game. And it'll be frustrating if it doesn't happen here. The best way to slow down a pass rush is to run right at them. And to say, we're going to run and run and run and run and suck that in, play action, beat them. Do that against Chicago.
Yeah, I think there's a status already where on play action, Russell Wilson had a perfect quarterback rating on Sunday. So obviously, he's obviously working when it works. Obviously, they had the big Tyler Lockett touchdown as well. Tariq Cohen in the running game for the Bears, Adam?
You really stole my thunder. I was about to say we don't give out fantasy tips or whatever, but if I was going to do one against the Seahawks, it would be Tariq Cohen, because I've just got this horrible vision of a dump-off from Trubisky who, you know, just managed to pass it to him, and a 71-yard touchdown run. I've just got these horrible, horrible thoughts of something like that happening. That hopefully won't. But the dink and dunk has always been something that seems to have hurt us ever since that blasted game in San Diego the year after we won the Super Bowl, where Rivers absolutely just paper cut us to pieces. That's always been my fear, and I think if we are going to lose on Monday from a defensive standpoint, that's where I do get a little bit concerned.
Yeah. Obviously, another guy on offense, Allen Robinson's one of their big free agent signings in the offseason. Could this be a case, Rob, where Shaquille Griffin's asked to shadow, or do you think if they didn't do it with Sherman, they're not going to do it with Shaquille?
No, I don't think they'll shadow, and I think they'll probably quite like Trey. This is going to sound strange, but they'll probably quite like Trey Flowers up against him, because Trey's quite quick and tall and long, and it's going to be that type of game where they'll throw it up to. I thought that Allen Robinson looked a little bit like he's not quite as fast as he was pre-injury in the game, but he was winning a lot of jump balls, and those sort of long frames. The long frame of Trey Flowers, if he can get a hand in there and palm it away. So if they end up getting matched up together, I think they'll be quite content with that. And do you know what? We'll learn a lot about Mitch Trubisky in this game, because he played better than I think people thought against Green Bay. And now's an opportunity, and I suspect the Bears will be favourites in this game based on what happened in week one. It's an opportunity for him to prove that he's taken a step forward, and it's an opportunity for the Seahawks to show that they mean business. I mean, I felt like if they were going to do anything this season, they would at least split this start. You know, one and one. If they go 0-2, and then it puts a lot of, you know, and you've got the Rams coming up in a few weeks' time. You know, I'm already calling that a loss. I mean, we'll not risk any injuries in that game.
100%.
Just give them that. So that's put you at three if you lose. You know, the Bears game, and then you really have to win those two home games to be in with any kind of, you know, if it's 1-4 or worse, then people are flooding to my blog, which isn't a bad thing to find out who we're going to draft in the top 10. So every clout.
He's someone who I think he only had 7 or 8 snaps on Sunday, but with Doug Baldwin's absence, Mark Dugard wrote a thing for The Athletic, sort of maybe nudging and nodding towards it happening. CJ Process could be a bit of a wild card in this game, couldn't he, if he's managed to stay healthy for 5 days? Because, I mean, he has wide receiver experience at least, and the screen game could be something which slows down the Kittle or Max of the world, couldn't it, a little bit? Obviously, if Process makes it through the week.
He's got to get off the plane safe. The steps and everything, it could be treacherous.
CJ Promesas is the kind of guy that Khalil Mack probably just has to look at to injure.
But Rob, we've mentioned you a few times in the podcast. I think we mentioned last time you were on. Me and Adam were in New York last year in week six, week seven, and it came up on the big screen that CJ Promesas was out of the game and he hadn't touched the ball. It was like really early in the first quarter. Just kind of looked at each other.
He'd been in one play and got injured in one play that he didn't touch the ball.
But you know, while we're talking about Procise though, so they've kept all of the running backs on the roster, obviously, and Davis was inactive in the game. I just feel like if you're going to have him active, and why wasn't he featured more? You know, I know that we've talked earlier that Carson should have had more of the snaps, but Penny was quite clearly rusty. They wanted to get him a bit of that rust off, perhaps. But to not see Procise at all, I mean, there could have been a game plan that involved a heck of a lot more Chris Carson, a bit of Penny, and a bit of Procise.
This may be nonsense, but Pete Carroll Stretch is the kind of guy that likes the idea of a CJ Procise, but in practice, that's just not his kind of player in the NFL.
It obviously come with different baggage. It's what we saw with Percy Harvin. I mean, you saw the video a few minutes before we traded for Percy Harvin, where he's basically drooling at the mere sight of Percy Harvin, and it was aided by Percy Harvin himself, but he had no idea how to use him really, apart from on kickoff returns, didn't he? It's kind of the same thing we're seeing with Prozois, and he was someone he was compared to when he come into the league. Are you confident on Sunday or Monday, Adam?
I'm more confident about Sunday than I am Monday. I have a feeling that, again, it would just be lack of star power that ends us missing out again by maybe 4 points.
Yeah. Rob?
I think a very similar game to week one. I think it's the kind of game that probably could go either way, and it's going to come down to that fourth quarter and whether or not the Seahawks can actually make a play either on defense or offense to get over the line, or will it be Chicago? And I think it will possibly go either way. And I can't say I'm confident, but it's too early to be too pessimistic. So I'm going to be hopeful, but I'm not confident.
I think I'm more confident than I was this time a week ago, moving into week one. I'm more confident of a win in Chicago than I was of a win in Denver. Also, we would, if it, nothing else, we get to see Michael Dixon punt on a bit closer to sea level in, compared to last week, at least. Score prediction, Adam?
Score prediction 21-17 Chicago.
Rob?
I'll go 30-27 Chicago.
I'll go 27-23 Chicago.
Oh, you nearly said it. You nearly said it.
Moving on. Obviously, it's week three of the college season. Rob, obviously, you are our go-to guy for all the college stuff as the draft rolls back around in 9, 8, 9, 10 months. Anyone caught your eye in the first, or anyone or any teams catching your eye for the first few weeks who could be eligible for the draft next April, May?
Oh, so many. I'm loving the draft this year. You know, the number of names that are jumping out so far. So from a quarterback perspective, not pick the Seahawks are looking at, but check out Steven Montez, the Colorado quarterback.
Right about him.
Oh my word! What a performance against Nebraska, which is going to be a tough place to go now. Scott Frost is there. What a performance! The accuracy on his deep ball, the release that he has, the size. He's like 235 pounds, but he's mobile. Such an exciting player. A lot of people talking about other quarterbacks at the moment. They should be talking about Steven Montez of Colorado. Check him out. He's got a great stretch coming up. I think they play UCLA, USC, Washington. Some of those games on the road. It's a great little run to see if he's the real deal. On defense, the SEC is loaded with talent. Some of the Devin White, linebacker at LSU, love that guy. Incredible player. DeAndre Walker doesn't get a lot of attention. Left linebacker at Georgia, more of like a Sam Leo type, could be a pass rusher. Really like the look of him. You've got Raquan Davis at Alabama, who just looks, to me, he's not got the physicality of Calais Campbell, but he's a quicker, he's got the same size and he's quicker. So he could be a slightly different player, but I think he's going to go in the top 10. He's an amazing player. Brian Burns at Florida State had a great first game. Derek Brown at Auburn, defensive tackle, sort of typical 3-1 technique type, really stout up front, but got some pass rush. Mention the Clemson quartet. They are, you know, a lot of people in the offseason were saying, are they as good as advertised? Because they were saying all four of them were going to go in the first round. They are as good as advertised. They are amazing. You've got Dexter Lawrence, who is a really athletic, mobile nose tackle. Great size, great power, but has got some pass rush to him. You've got Christian Wilkins, who's like a little cannonball, pass rusher, defensive tackle type. You've got Austin Bryant, who just comes off the edge and just keeps making plays. And then you've got Clelin Ferrell, who is that inside out defense. You know, just looks like a great defense, great get off, great length, ideal size, just looks the part, great character. And that's the thing, all of the guys have got exemplary character as well, and they all sort of made a pact together to come back and not declare for the last draft. Lawrence was ineligible, but the rest of them came back to play together to try and get one last national championship. So I think the scouts are going to love that. A lot of people know about Ed Oliver already at Houston.
He was insane against Arizona.
Yeah, do you know what? He is. I've got a little counter to that, though, because I wonder what he is at the next level, because he's really quick off the snap and he gets his head down and he runs. But you don't see swim rip. You don't see him bull rushing. You don't see him playing outside. Given his size, you'd think he'd probably be, you know, someone who could play a bit of end. You don't see that. He plays inside. And I worry at his size, whether he's playing inside all the time in the NFL, whether he's just going to get beasted in the run game, whether he's just going to get blown off the ball because he's not big. It's going to be something that scouts talk about. You know, where do you play him? What's his ideal fit? Is he a 5 and a 4 in a 3-4? Can he play 3 technique? Is he going to have to play end and then move inside? It's going to be interesting to see where they see him fitting, because he's an exceptional athlete. Yeah. It's just whether or not he can be that all-round defensive lineman at the next level, which could, you know, he's going to go in the top 10. It's just whether he goes top 5 or, you know, like 8th or something like that. Nick Bosa's going to be the number 1 overall pick, I think.
Yeah.
He
could be better than his brother, couldn't he?
Yes, I think he is, and he's quicker. I think that's the big thing. Joey was great and had great agility, but I think Nick's got that speed as well. I think the difference is, I think Joey's like a 4.87 runner, if memory serves, and I think Nick's been timed at 4.56.
Yeah.
So if he gets to the combine, if he gets to the combine, I think it's probably more like a 4.65. I think probably when he gets to the combine, he'll run like a 4.65, something like that, 4.68. But that's really good for a defensive end.
Yeah, just a few names that have popped up on my radar. A couple of them did last year. You might not have seen much of him this year. Ben Banagu at TCU. Have you seen anything of him?
Yeah, I've seen plenty of him. I think he's probably going to be sort of mid-round, day three type pass rusher. I mean, he needs to take a step forward this year, and needs to develop a little bit more. And there's quite a few like that. I mean, Miami's full of players who, you know, have sort of flirted with, you know, being really high picks, and they just need to put it all together. And I'd kind of put him in that range as well.
Yeah. Noah Fant, Iowa tight end.
Yeah, I've seen people talking about him as an early pick. I'm always suspicious of tight ends. And I saw him play very well. What was the game? Was it Michigan last year that he played really well in? I can't remember.
I think it was the
Ohio State game that I'm thinking about. But I'm always a little bit skeptical of tight ends. You know, they're an old school team. You know, they run the ball, big offensive linemen, big tight ends, and they feature the tight ends a lot more than other teams. And the production of the tight ends are often a lot better than they would be at other schools. So, and I kind of feel like you have to see tight ends test these days. I know Will Disley obviously wasn't a great tester, he's coming out a great start, but I think that for the most part you do have to see just what they are, because
because it's moving towards more like the Evan Engram types, isn't they?
More teams are going for that type, you know, essentially the big slot.
Although Evan Engram was weirdly unused against the Jags on Sunday. And one more name one of the surprises for me is how well Herm Edwards is doing at Arizona State. He's been helped a lot by Nikhil Harry, the wide receiver. He looks like he's playing a different level to everyone else against. Not the greatest opposition through 2 weeks, but he's a junior. He could be someone who could do earn himself a lot of money over the next few weeks, couldn't he?
I've watched a lot of him, and I have to say I was a bit underwhelmed. I was kind of hoping to see more. How can I put this into words? I think when you watch college receivers, I think it's the easiest position to tell whether someone's going to be really good or not. I don't know how to put that into a couple of sentences that would make sense. But you just kind of, you just know, I think it's the way that they catch the ball, the way that they high point the ball, the way that they break off the ropes. Yeah. You know, when you watched Odell Beckham, you could just tell he was going to be great. Okay. Yeah. And Jarvis Landry, you could tell he was going to be really good. But you could tell the difference between the two because they were playing for the same team. But you could tell who was on one level, who was on another level. When you watch Mike Evans at Texas A&M, you just have to put the game on and you'd say he was going to be great. And you kind of know who's really good. And when I watch him, there were some plays where there was a play in week one where he took, I think it was a wide receiver screen or something, a dump off into the flat, and he just sort of ran past he sort of dodged and weaved through about three defenders and broke off a huge 60-yard run. And you think, that's great. But then I watched a lot of games where they throw it to him on the sideline and he's not got his hands up. And he's kind of body catching, and he's trying to jump above the defender, and it hits him in the chest, and he catches it. I'm thinking the technique's all wrong there. Yeah. But then you see another play where he's high pointing it in the end zone. You think, well, where's the consistency with that? And you don't see him break it off. He's not a particularly quick. He's not a Keenan Allen type. You know that Keenan Allen was big, that similar size to Harry, but was just had that quickness about him, and playing in a bad passing offense as he was at California back then. It was before the Jared Goff time. He was still making plays because of his ability to get open quickly. I think he had a really good game against Ohio State when California were really bad, and you could still see that Keenan Allen was going to be good. And then with this guy, I just kind of feel like you just don't quite see that gliding, that quickness, or the great technique with the hands, or the competitive spirit. And I do think it is one of the easier positions to see whether someone's going to be good or not. And when I watched him, I kind of felt like I want to see more.
Yeah, obviously they run at like 4 a.m. on a Sunday morning as well, so they don't get a lot of eyes on them this side of the pond. But the bits I've seen in Arizona State, he has come away impressed. But a lot of it, as I said, is highlights more than actually full game. And one more thing before Adam jumps in with his husky questions. Did you see Kyler Murray changing his name, changing his mind, and sticking with football, or do you think you'd see him committing? He was a top 10 pick in the MLB draft back in June. But he looks like he's ready made for definitely college football, maybe the next level. Just see him changing his mind, or do you think he's committed to that?
That's a good question. It's a good question. I mean, I think generally it's going to come down to him, isn't it? Because Jameis Winston was a great baseball player, and would have gone very, very, and would have had a very successful MLB career, and he just chose football, and it's going to be what he sort of, what does he enjoy doing the most, I suppose, because he's been impressive. I think he has to give football, he's probably going to have to sort of go through his football career and sort of see how he feels about it at the end of the year, because it's probably too early for him to sort of really know, and he's going to have to get the feedback from agents and scouts and stuff like that. But I'm eager to see him. I've not seen Oklahoma in a full game yet, and he's got a great coach who can help him statistically, because the offense is very, very, very well done. I'm eager to see him, because Oklahoma, the type of team that seems to always be competitive. They never seem to have that collapse the way that some of the other bigger schools do, where they're just like, look at Florida State at the moment. They don't seem to have that kind of fall. So if they're competitive again, and I'm really looking forward to seeing him.
Yeah, I can't remember who they played last week, but it was like the Rams game on Monday night. It was a matter of time until they pulled away, and they did on the back of him and how his playmaking and just how composed he was and how assured and decisive he was. I do hope he does change his mind and commits to football and gets onto the next level NFL. Adam, Huskies?
Yeah, a couple of things that are sort of linked. You'd never like to criticise a guy that's not playing professionally, but the Jake Browning thing, how annoying is it that the NCAA rules mean that Jacob Eason can't take advantage of this unbelievable defence this team's got? And sort of linked to that, I was watching the Auburn game and messaged Stu, and I was thinking, even at 12-1, I worry that the committee are going to watch sort of Jake's arm strength and whatever and think they've almost got a reason not to put us in for that reason. Anything in that? I just feel a little bit flat about the quarterback position right now.
Yeah, I think that's a justifiable opinion to have there. And it's a shame, because Jake Brown, as his career's developed, he's not been able to sort of take it. And that doesn't, I don't mean take it to the next level in terms of, oh, he's going to be a first-round pick or anything like that, or become suddenly a really strong-arm QB.
He's not going to get drafted, surely.
No, he's not. He's not going to. I don't think he'd be maybe looking to even get a camp. But you've seen Peterson have quarterbacks in the past who have just been able to make the most of what's around them, and unfortunately for Jake Browning, he seems to not be able to do that. He can't make everybody else raise their game by just doing what he's supposed to do, and it is a little bit tough to watch. I think that you make a great point about Eason, because why is there not a situation where you can go, look what's happened at Georgia.
Yeah.
This guy's not bailing on Georgia and screwing them. I'm sure that Georgia are very. If both teams agree to it, if Georgia say, "Yeah, do you know what? We're going to let Jacob move on," and if he goes to Washington, surely if both teams agree to it, can't the NCAA just go, both teams have agreed to sort of almost like a trade almost, but there's no player changing hands, then he can play straight away, or he can at least compete to play straight away. Why does he have to sit out a year? It just seems. Like you say, a complete waste, not just a waste for the Huskies, but a waste for him. I mean, I'm intrigued to see what he can do, because he was a really highly touted player who has been very unlucky at Georgia, and I want to see what he can do.
Yeah.
We're just missing a guy with a bit of arm strength.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of showed with the guy who came in. Is it Hayner who came in? It was against the twos of FBS team, but he just looked how it's supposed to. It just looked a lot more decisive. I know, as I said, with the asterisks, it was against pretty weak
They should have beaten Auburn. They should have. What a huge missed opportunity that was.
Yeah. But also, one thing on the transfer, it is a bit, as a lot of things is with the NCAA, it's a bit like contradictory, because obviously you have people like Willie Taggart up and leaving Oregon after 1 year and all the commits that they got, and that, but he can go and coach the next season over Florida State, although he's not having a great time of it. It is a bit, it's just another case of the NCAA getting in their own way, isn't it, with that, the transfer rules they have.
Well, look, if a player isn't getting a chance to play for one team and there's another team giving him a chance to develop and earn a living and a career, And all of the teams have agreed to it. Look, if Eason had forced, he was trying to force his way out of Georgia, for example, and had not been, you know, a model player or whatever, you know, however you wanted to characterize it, and Georgia said, we're not happy with the fact that he wants to leave, and the NCAA could go, well, all right then, okay, then if he wants to transfer, he's got to sit out a year. But if Georgia agrees to it and Washington agrees to it and the player agrees, why can't common sense prevail in that situation? Work it on a case-by-case basis and go, yeah, do you know what? He can make that transfer and he can compete straight away.
Yeah. I mean, that's also something we could see in Alabama, isn't it, with Jalen Hurts and that quarterback situation. He could decide to transfer. Is it next year? He can redshirt and go somewhere else, can't he, for next year? Is that right?
If he graduates, I don't know what year is he at. If he graduates, then he can go and play straight away.
Yeah. Yeah, moving on, Adam, time for your favourite part. It's time for Get in the Bin.
First of all, this is an exciting time for our organization.
2017 Browns joined the 2008 Lions as the only teams to go 0-16.
Get in the Bin.
Give me Josh Freeman, who was the 17th pick in the first round, over Cam Newton, who was the number one overall pick.
And the 2015 AP Most Valuable Player is Cam Newton.
Get in the Bin.
Chip Kelly is an evolver, and he's a smart guy, and I think he's going to go to San Francisco and they're going to be a much more viable football franchise.
That the 49ers are expected to clean house and dismiss head coach Chip Kelly.
Get in the Bin.
Yeah, so Get in the Bin this week, Adam. I think you're primed and ready for your inductee this week. Obviously, Hugh Jackson is always in there, as he is every week until the end of time. Adam, this week?
I think Rob will be happy with this one. Just general Seahawk Twitter during a game is just so annoying now. I don't know if it's because like the NFL has become such a big product, people get way overexcited, but I'm really tired and bored of a hot take after a 2-yard gain from a running back or an inside handoff that you can't tell anything about, but everyone's got 19,000 opinions on every play. Just a bit boring, and I think people could, if they could just watch the game and enjoy it and just chill a bit, that would make everything a lot better. Yeah, Rob, you can probably comment on that one.
Oh, music to my ears. I've never been more frustrated with Twitter than I have in the last sort of 2 or 3 weeks. So what we've had is the knee-jerk reactions to rookie performances in preseason. So as soon as a rookie has a bad game in preseason, you've got a million hot takes. I said that this guy shouldn't have gone in the first round and stuff like that. So you have all of that from the general sort of Twitter NFL followers. Then you've got the Seahawks, like you say, we've got the Seahawks there. You know, everybody's got very strong opinions and must force them on you during the game. So, for example, something will happen in the first half. I told you that he shouldn't have played, or he told you he shouldn't have tried to do this, or look, I told you that this, you know, that you see things like that. Leonard, you know, Saquon Barkley's no good. I saw that tweet during the first half of the he ends up making one of the plays of the weekend, and you know, against really good Jaguars defense. You know, just stop, just take a step back. You know, I tweeted once during that Seahawks game, and I instantly regretted it. Because I just thought, this isn't me, you know, and I just put the defense looks a bit horrendous, and that was it. And I didn't really feel like that was, you know, an inappropriate thing to say in the first half, but it's the people who feel like after nearly every drive or every play they've got to pass comment, like we're all sat there waiting to hear what their review of it. Just watch the game, and then after the game, have an opinion.
Yeah.
Oh, but obviously, Will Disley is better than Jimmy Graham, though.
Don't even start me on that.
Rob, anyone to throw in this week? I don't think I've got anyone this week. I think Adam's just...
Well, it's uncapped because you know, I would have automatically gone for Seahawks Twitter at this point. because any opportunity to criticise... and look, and it's not just Seahawks. Twitter in general becomes a bit of a troubling echo chamber. So I guess I'll just throw in the bin once again the complete obsession that people have with talking about the running game. I don't have any issue with people criticising the running game.
As a general thing, you mean?
Yeah, it's just So or saying it's not worth it. I'll quite happily listen to that opinion. Mm-hmm. It's the never non-stop. don't talk about anything else nature of it. And it was, like I say, it was cropping up again at the weekend. You know, you have to have a review of every weekly performance of Leonard Fournette and Saquon Barkley and Zeke Elliott to try and prove that these early round running backs are useless and they should never ever take one ever, ever, ever. And yet, you know, I just watched Marshawn Lynch ploughing through 20 bodies at the weekend and think, how can you not be energised by that?
Yeah.
And just enjoy it. You know, running backs are fun.
Marshawn Lynch, it's so annoying watching him do what he did on Monday night. Yeah, I don't think I've got anyone, so I think I'll just bow down to Adam's choice. I think that's probably what I was going to put in for different reasons. Obviously we are now just 4 weeks away from the Seahawks moving and coming to London to face the Raiders at Wembley Stadium. All the tickets were, I think they're sold out. I think the game's sold out now. Also, there will be stuff coming about the Saturday night event at Leadenhall Revolution in the centre of London for the UK Seahawkers. Also, today I had a massive, and I mean a massive, package arrive from Irvine, California. So a massive thanks to Kim, Mark, and all the Helinski family for sending that stuff out. We will be raising money through auctions and straight sales of all their merchandise that they've sent over. All the money going to Helinski's Hope Foundation. As we did announce a couple of days ago on Facebook as well, we are going to be setting up shop in a pub somewhere in the centre of London and doing a few podcasts. Don't know if they're going to be live, probably not, with our technical ability, Adam. But that could be quite fun, especially with the list of names that we've submitted to the team, Adam.
Yeah, if we can't milk this week and pretend that we're actual podcasters, then we'll never get a chance. So let's do it properly.
So Rob, as you'll hear, that is your invite to pop on if you are down in the city. Also, I don't know what your plans are, but if you are in London a few days earlier, you are more than welcome to jump on.
I'm planning to try and be down there for the whole week. Whenever, because I think if there's any press conference or anything, we're going to try and go to those. Yeah. And just want to be around it for the week, and we'll definitely be there for all of the weekend as well.
Yeah, cool. It should be good until probably the game starts, wouldn't it? Before we go, Rob, where can people catch hold of you on social media and all the rest of it?
If you're willing to deal with the tweets, so there'll be less of those now because I'm actually changing job this week, so I'm probably not going to be tweeting as much from my personal account, but at Rob Staton for that. And if you want to head the website's seahawksdraftblog.com, and there is a lot of talk about the draft, but there's also a lot of talk about the Seahawks in general. There's a good community there who like to get into it, so log on and check it out.
Yeah, so the chapter Facebook is UK Seattle Seahawks Fans. The podcast is over on iTunes at The Pedestrian Podcast or on Podbean at thepedestrianpodcast.podbean.com. On Twitter it's at Seahawkers UK, personal at Stu_Court and at Adam D. Nathan. On Instagram is UK Seahawkers. Adam, as we keep saying, we do have a stable of guests that we call on. Rob is one of them, Michael Sean Dugar is on there, and those two in particular have got new jobs since they've been coming to this podcast. Is that a pat on the back for ourselves?
I think it's outrageous that we've not been cited as major reasons for it, to be honest.
I put you down as references. Did you not get a call?
Oh, no, that went to my work account.
Yeah, but a big congrats on the new job as well, Rob.
Looking forward to it, yeah.
Yeah, until next time, this has been the Pedestrian Podcast.
Go Hawks!
We just overthrew him a bit. You know, he might have had two or three more catches, so he was really in the right spot and deployed well for the game plan and all that. And I know nobody's been talking about this. He's been doing great for us, and really happy to see him contribute like that.
You know, it's just a cool opportunity to go out there in that first game and do some special things. You know, Russ was awesome, you know, putting the ball right where it needs to be. And, you know, I just have to make some plays. And, you know, obviously we got some work to do going forward, but it's a cool way to start for sure.